Hi, welcome to Restless Minds. This is season 2, episode 25. This week we have a special guest, Dr. F. Wasser, who is a friend of mine that I met whilst in New York. He is a model and also a doctor, and this week we're going to run through all things medical profession, modeling, mental health, and some other great projects that he's working on. Into the episode. Quick disclaimer before we start, everyone experiences ADHD, OCD and mental health in general differently, and we only speak from our own experiences, which may be totally different to yours. We also are not mental health professionals, but we do encourage anyone who thinks they might be affected to seek professional advice and diagnosis. So, hello Dr. F. Wasser, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Good, we've actually just been talking for like 15 minutes before we hit record, but I've got to say hi. Hi for the podcast.
I thought thank we were already doing it.
No, I hadn't hit record.
Well, I thought
we were just asking about his career.
Okay,
so we understood what his career was, and we got into a full-on chat. So right. Some missed content. But thank you for coming on the podcast. I messaged you, a few months ago now, saying that we wanted to see if you'd be interested. Then you listened, and you thought it was okay enough to come and join. So thank you.
Okay enough.
Doing that. I thought you were going to be like, nah, sorry, it's crap. I don't want to be on this. It's bad for the brand.
No, honestly, listening to your previous episodes, I just think what you guys are doing is great, and kind of the initiative that you took in starting this conversation in particular is people need to hear a different perspective on things, and your perspective is as important as a medical professional, so yeah, people need to get your take as well.
Thank you.
Do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself? Summarize, and then we'll go into the different sections as we go on.
So a little bit about myself. I'm a FOSA. I'm 27. I'm a doctor living and working in London. I've been modeling now for about 8 years and working on a few creative projects, currently not full-time in the NHS, but have been during the pandemic.
Lovely. Question as well. Do you remember how we met? Because I was telling Ellie before.
I do.
You joined.
I think so. Basically, after I graduated from uni, I went to New York to model full time. I think I ran into you in Zara.
Was it Zara? Yeah.
You said H&M, but
I thought it was H&M, but yeah. It probably was Zara. It's normally Zara I'm in.
Yeah, on Broadway. I was with my friend Tunde. Shout out Tunde. And I think we just overheard, I can't remember if we overheard you or you overheard us.
I think we overheard you, and we were like, oh my god, British accents. And
yeah, exactly.
And my friend D came over, yeah.
Yeah.
And now we've stayed in touch. Small world. And then we just found out before recording that you both worked on the same magazine.
Yeah, absolutely crazy.
Which is bizarre. Yeah. I guess that we can get into some of the questions we had then, just to start, if I
mm-hmm. Yeah, awesome.
If I lead. So the first one I was going to ask was, I guess you said you've been modeling for now close to 8 years. I guess you can start with how you kind of got into that. But then I guess whilst doing that and also becoming a doctor, how you've balanced the two different careers and how that's been, I guess, time management wise. Because I know you're also doing other stuff outside. How have you managed to balance and keep all of that going?
So I started modeling in my third year of uni, and it was just basically a friend saw a picture of me on Facebook and was like, oh, you should have a word with my agency, I'll put you in touch. I went in and met with them, and they thought I was okay enough to join the board. And the rest is kind of history.
Okay enough.
So I basically was doing a bit of this, a bit of that, and not working loads during uni, but kind of taking jobs where I could, and kind of building up my portfolio kind of thing. And when I graduated, I went full time for a while. For more than anything, it was just to kind of prove to myself that I actually could survive doing it full time. So up until that point, I always had the fallback of I'm at uni, so I'm busy anyway. So I never really had to fully commit to it. But this was kind of me throwing myself into it fully. But the plan was always to come back to medicine afterwards. So I lived in New York and was modeling full time for 2019. And 2020, I was back in the UK and started working. Kind of around pandemic time. Perfect time to start working.
Straight into the fire.
Honestly.
What's harder, like being a model or working on a ward?
I know you think that's like a really easy question.
No, I don't, because watch vlogs on YouTube of models during fashion week and they're all knackered.
Yeah, that's it. At the end of the day, a human is a human, and when you're tired, you're tired. So whatever made you tired is pretty irrelevant.
Yeah.
And you can kind of ascribe value to how you became tired, but that's just really neither here nor there. Mm-hmm. Like, if it's exhausting, either physically or mentally, it just is. And modeling is one of those things that is kind of painted as super glamorous all the time from the outside, but the amount of rejection that you receive and what it can do to your psyche is just, you can't even really imagine it unless you're in it. Because just imagine that your actual monetary value is tied directly to how you look. Directly. So you wake up one day and your face is puffy, or you've got a fat spot in the middle of your head.
Oh my God.
Well,
me every day.
Yeah, you go to that casting and try and make yourself feel like, and try and like kind of present your best self to them. Like, your confidence is shot. It's not an easy thing to do, and like doing that week on a day-to-day basis, on top of the fact that not only that these people look at you and say no, but also that no is directly affecting whether you can pay your rent or whether you can like fly home and see your parents next month. So yeah, it's just that kind of thing. Obviously, you know what you're getting into, and you take the good with the bad when you join an industry like the fashion, well, specifically the modeling industry. But I wouldn't say it's easy by any stretch of the imagination.
No. Have you ever experienced, I don't know what you call them, casting agents or people saying, you know, personal things or things that have stuck with you about how you look? Or is it more just people are just like, no, you're not what we're looking for?
I think generally people are kind of, don't know whether to call it like well-mannered enough or coy enough to just kind of be like, oh yeah, you're just not what we're looking for. Yeah. But there have been times when, I mean, I remember when I did my first kind of round of fashion weeks in 2016. I remember going to a casting in, I think it was Milan, and I just got to the door and they were like, yeah, we're not seeing any more black boys for the show.
Really?
And that was traveled. Like,
and that's why I was going to ask you next, actually, like onto the race side of things. Obviously, I think being a black male in fashion and also in the medical sphere, you know, the things we don't see as much as we should in terms of representation, and people on, I guess, it's not as pushed to the forefront of what we see generally. How have you found navigating race in the fashion industry, and I guess also as a doctor?
Like the picture of the black fetus that was going around the internet recently, yeah, you know, that medical drawing, and everyone was like, I've never seen a medical
drawing. That's it. It just makes you think, doesn't it? There was another med student, I can't remember his name right now, but he wrote a book called Mind the Gap, which is essentially dermatological images based on kind of non-Caucasian skin colors,
right,
and identifying conditions that we're not essentially not taught how to identify unless it's on white skin,
like meningitis or something. I don't know.
There's a whole range of things.
Yeah.
You're so sharp at the range. So it's kind of, it's an interesting, just an interesting situation to be in, because it's not, technically it's not overtly racist. It's just kind of the way things have traditionally been. If Western medicine originated in the West, obviously it's going to be Western imagery accompanying it. And that's just kind of the way things are, but it also is directly detrimental to people of color. Mm-hmm. And that, it's difficult to ignore that, especially when you are a person of color.
Yeah. And I guess from what you're saying, literally, as in it could be detrimental, like somebody could miss a diagnosis of something really serious just because they
100%.
Don't know that it might look different on black skin.
Exactly. It's really that simple. It's, I don't know how to identify this because I was never taught.
Mm.
I've never seen anything that looks like this.
Right. And
right.
I even blame someone for that.
Mm. Yeah, I remember I went in uni in like third year, height of exams. I was like super stressed. I was barely eating, barely drinking, whatever, just like in the library. And then I was getting changed and my flatmate was like, you've got this like rash on your back, like this really weird, these look like patches. I was all right. So I walked down to Boots and I went to see the pharmacist. And so I took off my shirt and they started to come around to the front of my chest as well. She was like, I've never seen anything like that. I don't know what that is. Like, so I don't know what that is. That is rare. And I was like, oh, like, do I need to go to A&E? She was like, honestly, I've never seen anything like that. She's like, what is that? And I was like, okay, fine, whatever. But to the point, I just had a fungal infection. Like the other doctor was like, oh, that's just what fungal infections look like on black skin. But she had just never seen it before, right? But like, I was freaking out. Like, I've got like some like terminal disease is going to kill me kind of thing. But it's exactly what you said, right? Like, if you haven't seen it before, you just don't know what it is. But people can miss diagnoses for stuff. It's kind of scary.
I mean, it's just ignorance, isn't it? But we've almost come to accept the ignorance as, oh, it just is what it is, which is just ridiculous. That's not how things should be or how they can be going forward. So I think it's really good that these people are taking the initiative and kind of making that literature.
Mm-hmm.
But it shouldn't be left to people who are the guy who wrote Mind the Gap is in medical school. So he's like, not even 25. And they were both in med school, and the guy who drew the black fetus is also in med school.
Right.
So these are
students educating the teachers.
Exactly.
And it's like, it shouldn't be that difficult for like the big companies that own textbooks, you know, like Pearson and all of those. I don't know. Yeah. You know, the ones like, it shouldn't be that difficult for them to rewrite these books and include diversity.
They just don't care, really, essentially. Until like it becomes like, I guess, worth the money they spend, or that it gets campaigned or lobbied or trends that people want to see more, which is kind of a shame. That's kind of how things work, that the marginalized groups have to take on themselves to force the care. But I've heard of Mind the Gap, so I guess it is as hard as it is for those students having to do that, it's working because people are kind of taking notice now.
There you go.
So going back to what you were just saying about the modeling in Milan thing, were you going to say that you literally went there for that casting and then you had to leave at the door?
Yeah, I just had to turn around and go home home. That was it. And that wasn't that uncommon at that time either. Mm. I guess that was kind of closer to the back end of like shortly after that thing started to turn around a bit. Haven't really had an experience like that since. But there are definitely times when you do feel there's just kind of an unspoken, no black people for this.
Right.
No one says it, but I mean, at the end of the day, imagery speaks for itself. And if you feel like your target audience is not black people, then you're going to avoid putting them on your brand. And I think that's what it comes down to.
It's so crazy because I was watching The Wheel of Time last week, you know, like it's an adaptation of the book. It's like, I want to say sci-fi, it's like fantasy, it's like Lord of the Rings. And it has like a diverse cast, same as like Bridgerton. And it's crazy to me now that all the period dramas I watched growing up as a kid, my sister and I were obsessed with like Jane Austen ones, every single person in them is white, which is not only historically inaccurate, but also it doesn't even matter if it was, like you should just get the best actor or actress for the part. But I'm glad that that's changing in TV, but that's only such a recent change that even historical TV shows have
just
a
diverse cast. I've been rewatching things recently. I had COVID at the start of the year, so I was kind of stuck at home for 10 days. And I was just like rewatching things on Disney Plus and Netflix and thinking, what's going on? Like, I haven't seen a black person in this entire season. It's crazy. But that's just really what TV was like, not even 10 years ago.
But I didn't even as a kid, I didn't even think that it was wrong. I just thought like, that's life. I was like, oh, like that's it. Like, you know, like, black people aren't on TV, and I know they exist because like I've got family. My family's black, right? And, they're black friends at school, but you just kind of just like, we are just not cast in these shows unless we're cast as like a drug dealer or a gang member or like some kind of like, you know, token character that like has a few lines and that's a bit stupid. And I remember like when I wanted to do acting before I finished uni, something I went to an agency in London. They were like, oh, you know, just so you know, before you join, we're only putting you forward for roles as a gang member or a black student who's badly behaved in school, because that's all we get jobs for. Like, all the jobs for black people are those two things. So they were like, are you comfortable with doing that? Otherwise, don't bother joining the agency. I didn't join, obviously. But like, that was just a commonplace conversation to my face, sat in the office. It's like, just so you know, this is all you can be if you want to be an actor. So like, this is your career. And I wanted to ask, I guess, off the back of your question, I guess, so BLM has happened since we've been in COVID and like George Floyd and all that kind of stuff. Have you seen a shift to now like putting black people in everything because it's like a box ticking exercise, or something like brands that weren't before previously that way representative now suddenly having an interest in it? Because for me, I feel like it's good to see representation, but sometimes it feels like people are just doing it to appease what's being said online rather than actually caring. And we had the thing last year where lots of these companies, their list of boards of directors were released and actually like there were no women or people of color on them. So like, I guess the dissonance between like doing it in your marketing and branding because like it makes you look like you're involved in the cause versus actually doing it. Have you experienced that, I guess, from the inside?
I definitely noticed kind of a change in the kind of options I was going through through my agencies, and brands just a bit more willing to, I don't even want to say take a chance on using a black model because it just sounds inappropriate, to be honest. But kind of more like using more black models, essentially. But I mean, I'm kind of in two minds about it, because at the end of the day, would I rather a black model has the work or not? Yes, I would. Mm. The fact that it's performative.
That's the word.
The fact that it might be performative is not, almost doesn't matter at that point, because at the end of the day, the black person got the job, and hopefully that will open further doors for more black models to get more jobs. Mm-hmm. The fact that it's performative in the moment is not what any of us would want, but if that's all that we can get right now, I guess you have to kind of grab onto it and try and like kind of leverage that into something better going forward.
Mm-hmm. I remember, I don't know why I was watching this, but I was watching a documentary with like Alexander Shulman, who was like the ex-British editor of Vogue a few years ago, and she was making comments because somebody asked her, like, there'd only been so many black or women of color on the front of British Vogue, and it was like a tiny, tiny number. I think maybe Naomi Campbell was like one of the only ones, and she was sort of giving this basically racist answer as to why she'd made that decision. I was wondering, you know, Edward Enninful, is that how that's his name, right? The guy who's the editor of British Vogue. Since he took over, do you feel like that's created some shifts in the industry that you've noticed?
The thing is, it's just someone in a position of power with a black perspective, you can't replicate that with as much kind of diversity training as you, like, you have diversity training coming out of their ears. Like, there's nothing could replace someone who has lived the black experience and then been put in a position to tell the stories of black people and represent them. So, I mean, even the most recent Vogue cover and kind of the caption that he posted on Instagram, like, to go with that, just basically he was saying he's noticed a real shift in like the use of black models on through the fashion weeks this season. And it comes from people like him being in positions of power. It comes from people like Virgil making an effort to put black models in their campaigns and have these global brands embodying black culture in their campaigns and in the way they kind of in their campaigns and in the way that they design and produce clothes.
I was just checking because I was trying to remember the story. I saw that the recent cover he did for Vogue, people are kind of critiquing him for reversed let me get the title because it was an interesting title for this page. Under Fire for reverse bleaching dark skin models, and I guess the argument is that he's made the models look darker than they are. And I don't know what you guys think about this, but for me it's interesting because it's never a problem when people who are white want to be tanned or whatever, or want to like use lighting to look a certain way, or vice versa. If people who are of color, lighting's used to make their skin appear lighter, and that's been fine in the industry for years and no one's had an issue with that. But I think a black person in a position of power making a choice to highlight the extent to which dark skin ranges and to show that that's still beautiful, I can't see why people can then step in and be like, that's not fine. But that's me personally.
I think I did see this morning on Instagram, I can't remember the name, but a mixed race model was saying how her skin's often been edited to be a lot darker without her being spoken to about it, or like, and she just said that she felt uncomfortable about that. But I mean, I don't personally have an opinion about it. I don't feel like I can, because I'm not speaking from experience.
Yeah. So my perspective on this is, so when I first saw the cover, I did kind of, more than anything, I think it's just the fact that every time they say a black person should be on the cover, or like as a high fashion, every time a black model is kind of represented in high fashion, they have to be extra, extra striking. They have to look like art. Mm-hmm. They have to have the darkest skin, the strongest cheekbones.
Like Grace Jones, kind of.
Exactly. Yeah.
The image that they're often, like shaved head often, I find, like basically look like Grace Jones.
And unless you look like this, unless you look like a piece of art, then you almost can't, you can't be in those places, in those spaces. But that doesn't make any
that's
sense.
That's the only version of beauty they want, essentially, right? Exactly. This is the black we like, or we believe is beautiful or artistic, but if not that, they don't want it.
Exactly. But I don't even know if they're necessarily saying that. All I know is that they're saying is that this is interesting. This is different. I don't know if they're saying this is our standard of beauty, because I don't believe that's what they necessarily think is the standard of black beauty. It definitely doesn't represent 99% of the black people that they know and meet on a daily basis. So them almost using black people as artwork is another again, slightly uncomfortable. But then it again comes down to, would I rather they not have black people on the cover of British Vogue, or would I rather they did this? I would still rather they did this, because this is the thing opens the door to the next things.
Yeah, it's tough, because I think even within the like, I guess, the race conversation and representation in TV of people of color, specifically black people, within that there is the kind of like light skin versus dark skin argument and battle. And I was reading an article yesterday where someone was saying, you know, it's really good to see that in the last year or so that Netflix and like HBO and all these big production houses have started to have representation of people of color of all different races within TV. But whenever they are casting a black model, the black model is typically either mixed race or really light skinned. And so again, it's the question of, is media again choosing what is qualified as black and presenting something that's palatable that people can be, oh, I find it's a black person, like it's personal color, which is fine. But as you said, like that doesn't represent probably about 60-70% of the black population, because there's more than just light skinned or mixed race people. But I've noticed that even in Netflix as well, like there's a black wife or a black mother or a black partner or whatever, but they're always lighter skinned or mixed race, which of course does qualify under being black, but I think it's a very, like, it's a selective choice by media to represent that in a certain kind of way. So I think there's a lot of work left to be done.
That's it. It's kind of the choice of narrative. That it's kind of what you're implying by saying that. I think that's the thing that makes people feel makes me feel uncomfortable. And what hopefully is will start to change, because like you say, that is not a representation of the black population, where there is a whole range of black people, and all of them they all have a collective story, but they all have individual stories to be told as well.
Sorry, I just wanted to ask about like your favorite or sort of more positive experiences in modeling, like moments where you have felt represented or just had a really great time, or a campaign that was just really fun.
Well, to be honest, as for all the like kind of
I hate it all. I don't want to be a model anymore.
For all like the kind of the quite negative things that I've just said about it, modeling definitely changed my life and kind of opened up opportunities and perspectives that I never would have been able to, that I never would have had the opportunity to experience, things that I faced that I never would have had the opportunity to go. So I'm really, really grateful for it. And I enjoy it. In terms of like my favorite job ever.
Love it. It's like slag it off. But I'm really grateful. Can I know you?
I think my favorite, my mind always just goes to this one campaign I did for Google. I mean, it's not necessarily what people think of when they think of fashion modeling, but it was for like the Pixel 4 phone, and we shot it in San Francisco, in this national park that was, they drove us up to a point that was literally above the clouds, like looking down onto the clouds, and through the clouds you could see the bay just curving around, and that was just the most insane experience with. And we had kids on set that day. We had like a really big team, all people from a kind of different walks of life. Yeah, it was just a really fun, interesting day.
That sounds amazing.
That sounds very fun.
I guess, have you traveled quite a lot? There are just so many. That's cool. I mean, with you know, I've always wondered about models, and I get to ask one, but like, do you have lessons in like how to pose and stuff? Because how do you know what to do with your face and your arms and your like, or does it just, is it just like come naturally to you?
It definitely doesn't. Well, it didn't come naturally to me, at least. But I remember my first set of like Polaroids in the agency, which is basically the images that they send out to clients, and basically it's like to kind of show what you look like. And it was, I'd signed maybe the week before, and my agent just looked at them and was like, "What? I'm gonna print out some pictures for you.
Oh my god!
You copy the pictures." but honestly, I think it's just experience and just kind of knowing what works for you.
Yeah.
I kind of do it on autopilot because it has been so long. But when I was in uni and I was like kind of working for a bit and then not working for like a while. I would always get rusty and have to kind of like get back into the groove of things again. But after a while, you just learn what definitely doesn't work on camera, and you don't do that.
Okay. Cool. And then I guess we've spoken a lot about you being in front of the camera. You also are a photographer and you get behind the camera. I don't know if you want to talk a bit about some of
how
you
got into.
I thought of it and I was like, wow, here we go. Here's my moment.
Smooth.
Yeah, about how you got into photography, getting behind the camera, some of the projects you've done. Be cool to hear about.
So, how did I get into photography? I'm still like quite hesitant about describing myself as a photographer, but I do enjoy practicing photography. But basically, I would say after uni, obviously med school is quite intense. Don't have a lot of time for other things. And I already had modeling to focus on. So it was literally like studying, modeling. My summers were like completely devoted to modeling. Didn't go on, like hardly went on holiday. Just like if I had exams, I would try and finish them as early as I could. And if I had placements, I would like kind of not rush through them, but like literally.
You're fine. You can go. You're fine. You can go. You're fine.
That lump. Don't worry about checking it. It's fine.
It was literally just like that. So when I finished uni, I was kind of like, I don't really know what I like. And I just took that opportunity, that time that I spent in New York after uni, to kind of explore what I found interesting and how I wanted to use my time and my free time. My creative muscle had kind of started to waste away during uni because I'd never really exercised it. Simple as that. Like I never explored any of like kind of my creative whims just because I didn't really feel I had time for it. I didn't really feel like I was gaining anything from it in particular. Which kind of in hindsight, I wish I did spend a bit more time like trying to explore that side of myself, because I'm naturally creative and that's kind of my inclination automatically. I really had to kind of box myself in order to finish a degree in medicine. So that's kind of where photography came from. It was a medium that I was already quite familiar with just from modeling and like being around a lot of photographers, and also something that I kind of, I'd always admired, but never had had the patience to kind of give proper attention. So having that free time after uni was just, honestly, it was just a godsend, because that's just what I needed. I needed the time to explore something that I hadn't paid enough, just a side of myself that I hadn't paid attention to. And photography was the one that stuck, I guess, or at least like kind of the gateway drug into other creative endeavors.
Not a doctor talking about gateway drugs on the air. And you said you did a project recently that isn't out, but will be out soon. Do you want to, what was that? How did you get the inspiration to do that? How did you kind of set up like doing it during the pandemic and everything, and how you found it?
So the current photography project I'm working on is with a friend of mine named Shanice, who runs OOM Studio. And basically, it's a commentary on our relationship with food, or like society's relationship with food. It's called It Is What It Isn't. And essentially, the idea is to portray food in ways and lights that we wouldn't usually look at it. So it's kind of an experimental photography project. The idea is that food has no inherent moral value, but mm-hmm. because of society and our experiences, we place value on it, and we call foods dirty, or we call other foods clean, or we say this mm-hmm. is bad for you, when in reality, it's all a spectrum. And
yeah.
if you eat, I don't know, 6 kilos of broccoli in one day, you're not going to be fine. Like, that's going to, your body's not going to process that.
You heard it here first, guys. From yeah. a doctor.
Don't eat broccoli. He's obviously doctor.
That's an extreme example. But like, kind of the premise is true. Trust me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, that's a little humble flex. I'm a doctor, guys.
I just think art's a really good way to kind of get that message across, and yeah. hopefully we can create images that are striking enough to kind of catch people's attention and make them stop and think about what they're looking at, mm-hmm. and kind of challenge their own perceptions of what they think food is or isn't. That's the overarching idea of the project.
Yeah, that sounds so cool. And it's actually, there's such an inherent moral value to food, especially in Ireland. Like, my grandma's Irish and my mum was brought up here, but she is very Irish culturally. And we were laughing at this TikTok the other day, this girl has, who's Irish, where like she's like offering her mum chips and her mum's like, no, I don't want one. And then eventually she's like, okay, give me one then. I'm just going to have a Tic Tac for lunch tomorrow. And I'm like, not going to eat anything until dinner. And it's like, you're always like adding things up of what you're allowed to eat, and exactly. deducting things and balancing it. And that's why I like Ruby Tando so much, because she was one of the first people who wrote kind of calling out like Deliciously Ella and all of that shit about, you know, all this kind of clean eating, even though Deliciously Ella is like part of the Sainsbury's family. So she's like an heiress of Sainsbury's. Yeah.
Oh, is she?
Yeah, my girlfriend told me that the other day, actually.
No. Yeah,
like protein balls and whatever. But I actually wanted to ask you, it's interesting you talk about food, because I was wondering, being a doctor, obviously focusing on health or healing other people, and then being in the modeling industry, which itself perpetuates certain beauty standards, like not only we've kind of spoken about race as well, but also in terms of obviously like
appearance.
I know things are changing with campaigns for sure, and I think in the past 3 years, brands, even just like I was on the Monkey website the other day, and they have like all different body types showing the clothes. Mm-hmm. Things are different, but they're still very much like the standard is to be very thin. And I was just wondering, how do you kind of, obviously it's not on your shoulders to stop that, but I just mean,
how do you sleep at night? Do you know what you're doing?
Guilty. But like, when you're choosing brands to work with, or you're, I don't know, just is that ever something that you think about?
Yeah.
But also, I know you're saying that as a black man in the industry, you're kind of in the minority. So also, therefore, you being in campaigns is positive in the sense that it's representative as well. Mm. But also, you're very physically fit. Timmy and I were looking at pictures of you.
I was asking him how he gets these abs and how he gets this. So I was like, what?
You know, so like, do you ever think, oh, am I perpetuating, you know, an image of what it should be to be a man or a black man that maybe isn't attainable to everybody and therefore is in some way upholding beauty standards?
Honestly, it's kind of a tricky one because I feel like I don't necessarily work with any brands whose kind of core messages I disagree with.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of kind of body standards, it seemed like in the male, I think there's a kind of a quite a big distinction between the male modeling industry and the female modeling industry.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of kind of being told you need to lose weight or you need to do this, you need to do X, Y, Z with your body, I've never really had that in my in my career. But if you speak to any female model, I would say almost all of them would have experienced a conversation along the lines of you need to lose weight.
Right.
So I don't know. It wasn't even necessarily something that I even considered at all until maybe until I started to see kind of different body size, kind of bodies,
types.
Sorry, I did a garble question, but like, you know, Rihanna, like on the Fenty website, did you see that one of it was like men's boxers and there was a guy who was like, I don't know what I'll say, plus size, but he was just like, didn't have a six pack. Well, I don't know, I don't know if he wasn't even really plus size, he was just like
normal body.
Yeah,
normal. And everyone was like, and I thought, yeah, I've never seen that. I mean, not that I look at men's boxers online, but you know what I mean? Like, I've never seen a male model either. But sorry, carry on. But yeah, I guess I get what you're saying.
That's a positive thing. That can only be a positive thing if people feel more comfortable in the kind of shopping online and like looking at clothes and they feel like that's more representative of where they're at. Why would anybody be against that?
Yeah, you've just made me think of an interesting question. Like, I was going to say, like, it kind of ties back to what we were saying at the start, like being a kid and watching TV and not seeing anybody outside of the white race makes you feel like you kind of accept like that's just it until you start seeing people of color. You're like, oh wow, like actually, like, why don't we have people of color in it? I can imagine, like, similar to you, Ellie, with modeling, I've noticed now as well, I follow a lot of fashion blogs and stuff, and also like just Fenty as well, seeing normal bodies, I'm like, wait, hold on, why don't we have normal body types in everything, right? Because when I'm looking at like a pair of boxers or a t-shirt or whatever, like, I don't have a six pack, I don't really go to gym that often, but like when I see someone wearing it, I'm like picturing myself as if I had abs and I was wearing the boxer. Yeah. Whereas, like, I like to just picture myself wearing a pair of jeans as I am, and that would be completely normal. But I wonder, because I was thinking just now, like, as I've gotten older, I've started to care more about my appearance. Like, I've had my teeth whitened recently and I'm trying to like exercise and go to the gym. And I wonder if, I guess for you guys as well, do you think that as adults we care more because we're getting older, or because we're just more exposed to social media and like what we're fed by campaigns? Because as a kid, I didn't care about anything. I don't know if that's because I was a kid or because I wasn't paying attention to what I've seen as like the good standard.
Well, even at uni?
At uni, I honestly didn't care at uni. Like, I literally would like cycle around. I'd dress, I wear whatever, I'd eat whatever. And I honestly felt fine and felt good. But I think in the last like 2 years, I'm like, okay, I should probably start cycling more. And okay, I should probably shouldn't eat that because like, I'm gonna, like, love handles. And okay, like, abs, I don't have abs. And okay, like, my hair's a bit messy. And like, my beard, my skin, my son. Like, there are all these things that I'm actually like hyper aware of now that 2 years ago, I would honestly just be like, wake up, leave the house and be like, this is me. Like, who fucking cares, right? But now I'm kind of like in a different space, and it's shifted for me recently. And maybe you guys don't care either still, but maybe it's just me. But I'm interested to see what you guys think.
For me personally, I think, well, first I started getting into like kind of the modeling industry when I was what, 19 20. So like, it's always kind of been, this is your job, your job is to stay in shape, your job is to wear your skin and get a haircut, like when you need a haircut, simple. But I also think that it's kind of always just been in kind of my personality. Maybe it's something that, maybe it's my mom, I don't know, like kind of drilled it into me. But it's, I've always kind of cared about like what I was wearing or how I looked. I might have not been correct in my assessment of how good or bad I looked.
Facebook 2012.
Yeah, it's like,
I love this Aztec, guys. Aztec is so on trend.
Yeah, don't go through the Facebook memories.
Fine. What about you, Ellie?
I also feel like maybe that's slightly male privilege from you, Timmy. I don't know, as in like as a woman growing up. And I think it's very similar for men, to be fair. I don't think it's that different. But as in you're constantly bombarded with you should look like this. You should be wearing makeup from year seven when you've got basically baby skin, but you're going to cover yourself in stuff. And I think I'm quite lucky in that my metabolism, it means I've always been quite thin. But that's interesting, actually, because I remember, like, obviously, like, the ideal body type has kind of changed, partly because of the Kardashians, like, the whole thing of, like, you want to be thick or have, like, a big bum and the tiny waist. And I'm just, like, quite straight up and down. So I remember being a teenager and people, that was kind of the ideal, but even though I didn't like it. But now, like, being really flat-chested and, like, really flat-bummed is not. But I suppose I'm still, it doesn't bother me that much. I kind of just accept it, but also I think I've got that people talk a lot online about like thin privilege or whatever, where like you don't realize, but people almost treat you nicer in society because like, I'm a white woman with long hair and I'm quite thin. So I'm not thin, but I'm just like, you know, on the lighter side, whatever. So I guess I don't have to think about, but I criticize my appearance all the time. But then I think with ADHD as well, it means that some days I just like won't even brush my hair, but because I'm like rushing around, running around, doing stuff.
You're going to say teeth.
You know what I mean? I wear like the same. Oh yeah, that's like a special treat in the evening. I'm like, I can't be bothered.
I only ask because like a lot of my friends now, like, what should we do this weekend? Should we go on a cycle? Or should we go to this class? Like, everyone seems to be doing some kind of like health kick or like trying to eat less or counting their calories on City Map. Or like, a lot of my friends now like are very focused on like being healthy and being in good shape and looking well. Like, it definitely wasn't like this pre-pandemic. And I've even noticed on like on my Instagram, as I scroll now, I follow way more like gym fitness people, like here's how to do like abs in 8 days and here's how this, and like my focus seems to shift. And I don't know if it's just like that's what happens when you get older, you just have to take care of your body, but it's just was an interesting thought of mine. But yeah,
well, I've got wrinkles now, sorry. Me and my friend were talking about retinol the other day for half an hour. You guys are lucky because you're black. You're going to age so much better. You know, like couples come into the pub I work in and there's one couple in particular. It's like a black woman, a white man. And I think they're probably both in their 60s. They're the same age. He looks like his face has fallen off a cliff. Oh, and she looks about 40. But I asked them and they said they've been married for like 40 years. So they're definitely the same age. They have kids who've come in before as well. But like, obviously he's aging at like double the rate that she is aging at. You're so lucky. I'm over here with crow's feet at 25.
Anyway. You do not have freckles. You don't have a wrinkle, sorry.
I honestly do. I'm going to show you. They've actually come up. Like, honestly, you will be shocked.
Oh, dear. You should sleep some more. Yeah. I was going to ask you as well, before we get into the weird realms of wrinkles and what else. Health push. So you were speaking a bit about it before we start recording. I guess tell us a bit about that, how you started that. So you've got so many side hustles and side projects and things going on. But tell us about Health Push and what you do with that.
So when Health Push initially started, it was kind of in that exploratory period like after uni where I was like, I know I like doing things outside of medicine and modeling, but I just don't know exactly what that looks like at the moment. So over time, it's kind of crystallized into what I think is a really, really important platform, or will be hopefully a really important platform for healthcare workers, which is essentially a 360 degree well-being service for help people working in healthcare. The rates of burnout in healthcare are insane, and these are only the reported rates of burnout. Not to mention the people who don't even realize they're burned out. I remember one day going into the doctor's mess at hospital, and I'd been tired for 2 months straight, literally, like as in I have a full weekend of sleep and on Monday I'm still tired. I remember just sitting down, like literally collapsing into the chair and like opening my phone and like Googling the symptoms of burnout, and I was like, check. Oh, looks like I'm actually burned out. And I just feel as though there's no real support system. I mean, a lot of workplaces have kind of wellness programs and that kind of thing. Firstly, the NHS doesn't have like any official wellness program. There's a British Medical Association, which is essentially meant to be like a union for doctors. I would say, as definitely doctors of our generation, most of them don't really pay that much attention. Mm-hmm. So what Health Push is going to be is essentially a space where doctors can care for their well-being. So subsidized therapy, careers counseling, kind of well-being activities, run club, artist therapy is something that I'm really focusing on at the moment, and kind of the healing qualities of art and social prescribing. So hopefully it will be just something that gives back to the community, especially particularly kind of doctors between the age of, I would say, like 23, when a lot of people graduate, and maybe like 35. It's kind of, it feels like no man's land. You're constantly doing exams, you're changing jobs, or basically changing location every one or 2 years. You're just uprooting your whole life constantly. No real support system, no kind of, I mean, obviously you have your GP, and you have, I'm sure there's something, there's mental health services in a lot of trusts, but if there was kind of a core thing that didn't feel like you were going back to your place of work for help, something was a little bit separate and like looked different and felt different, where people could feel safe and kind of hopefully heal and rest, like truly rest, and interact with people who actually understand what they're going through, and how to kind of, who've been through it and can hopefully guide them through it.
Wow, that sounds amazing.
I love the tagline. It says well-being for well-doers. And it reminds me of that no, it's cool. It reminds me of the the quote from Juvenal, the Roman poet, which is like, who watches the watchman or who guards the guards, right? Like, I think the NHS is, you know, it's like, they do all the things we need to keep people alive, and like, they watch over all of us, but like, who's actually watching the people that are taking care of us? No, it's cool. I think it's really cool.
You both
cool
need to
idea
just work in PR.
No, yeah. I mean,
Kevin Wright jingle. That was good.
Yeah.
It's funny because it's not funny at all, but my friend Thea is a doctor, and I remember during COVID, I texted her one day during lockdown. I was just like, oh, you know, she was like, how are you? And I was like, yeah, I feel quite low today. You know, made a cake. Well, I didn't make a cake. I don't know what I did. Blah, blah. How are you? She was like, yeah, I turned off 3 people's life support machines today. And I obviously gave her the support I could. But as you said, unless you're going through that, it's just an insane job and it's an insane experience. Other people can't relate to you, only those that are doing it too.
And like, it's all so strange because you would think that she would be really sad, but you experience death so frequently that you become really quite detached from it.
Literally the other day she was texting me and she was like, BRB, cardiac arrest just come in. And the guy died on the table. She texted me about 45 minutes later. But it's so normal for her that I was like, oh my God, babe. And she was like, yeah, no, it's fine. Just when I go here now, I can call you now. Like, as in like, oh, the cardiac arrest is over. He's dead. So I can ring you now to chat about plans for the weekend. Not in a I don't care way.
But as in like, matter of fact,
That's my day. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It's matter of fact. It literally is the job. And if you were, if you kind of broke down of every patient who died, you couldn't get through a day, let alone a week or a career. So that in itself is quite a strange kind of swing to have, like from med student where you're just like, oh my goodness, I can't believe, to kind of, it's your job and
this is every day.
You actually have to meet your friend for dinner afterwards. So this can't like ruin your entire day.
The question that Ellie actually added to our list later, earlier today, when you were doing your training to become a doctor, was there, I guess in the mental health part of it, was there a focus on ADHD and OCD? Like, how much do you actually know? Because we found through a lot of, I guess, speaking to guests and stuff that people, when they go and see the doctor or GP, a lot of people don't actually know. So often you get referred to a specialist who actually is then like super qualified and can like discuss it in detail. But most general doctors actually aren't too, I guess, well prescribed to actually diagnose people.
And just adding to that, I just wonder, sorry, I know you rotate and do different things, but like, what wards do you work on, or do you work in A&E, or like, what do you
So at the moment, okay, which one should I answer first?
Sorry. I just thought that knowing where you work might make sense to the patients that you deal with.
So up to this point, I spent most of my time working in trauma surgery, orthopedic surgery, which is like all broken bones. Trauma is like mostly like car crashes and stabbings, that kind of thing. And now I'm working on mostly on medicine So that's quite a wide range of things.
Yeah.
When you say medicine, as in like prescribing medicine?
When I say medicine.
Okay. Sorry, I was like, medicine, I was like, you're a doctor. Aren't you a dog, like, medicine, I was like, you're a doctor, I get it. Like, you're saying it.
Yeah, it's like quite a well, like a well described boundary in medicine between kind of surgery and medicine.
Okay, fine.
Almost.
Are
like
you actually sewing people up?
No. So I'm a junior doctor. So
right. Sorry. Yeah.
So mostly, if you're working in surgery as a junior, you do have opportunities to go to theatre and like kind of assist in operations. But the majority of your work is on the wards for like pre-care and post-care of surgical patients. Okay. Mm-hmm. In terms of medicine, basically, when a patient comes to A&E, they need to be assessed by the A&E doctor, and then the A&E doctor calls a specialty to kind of take over the care of the patient. So they either call surgery if they need surgical intervention, or they call the medics. This is a simplified version, but they call the medics. Mm-hmm. The medics say, oh, this patient can be fixed with XYZ and go home, or this patient needs to be admitted to the hospital and treated over a period of however long. So I'm working mostly, so now I'm working part-time at the hospital. I'm working mostly in medicine.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
This is cool.
Largely ward-based work.
And so I guess you've done quite a range then, I guess, between the different things you've rotated through. And then is there anything that you've enjoyed more, that you feel more passionate about, that you'd like to, I guess, go into and specialise in? Or is it still too early to kind of decide what path of...
So honestly, for me, I don't see myself in long-term hospital medicine.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see it as like kind of... I don't think it's the best... It's the place that my skills would be best utilised, like me personally.
Mm-hmm.
I do enjoy hospital medicine because it's interesting, it's challenging, and people are so grateful. Like, you are genuinely helping people with your knowledge on a daily basis, and that, who wouldn't feel good about that? But in terms of like making a career out of it long term, it's not really how I see myself spending my time.
It sounds quite unsustainable, as in people are constantly burnt out, it's exhausting. I don't know, I just feel like it would be hard. People, I suppose we're young now as well, I don't know, but thinking about doing it for your whole life.
Yeah, people are constantly burnt out because the NHS is horrifically understaffed. But I don't really see that changing. Like, so I'm doing a master's in public health now, which is basically, public health is everything pertaining to like the health of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, how the NHS is structured, why it's structured that way, where funding goes, like how important are GPs or how unimportant are GPs, and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the NHS has only existed since 1948, post-war. And from its very inception, it was losing money. It was unaffordable.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, it's crazy.
What a business model, day one. We're broke. It's like, guys.
But that was it. It was more of like we're all banding together. It's post-war. So like, everyone deserves healthcare. Like, we all got through this together going forward.
Obviously, what's his name? Like, not Bentham. It was like the something report. I remember doing this at school. I can't remember. The guy that wrote the report that was like, we should help the NHS. I don't know. I don't
remember the name. But essentially, like, kind of going forward, no one could have really predicted how expensive treatments would get and the exponential growth of the population. Mm. So treatments are getting more expensive. There are more people to administer those treatments to. I mean,
the model is not broken.
For free.
Yeah, exactly. It's like
it's Bevan, really, by the way. Yeah, it's not.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, do you want to answer Timmy's question? Because I completely sidetracked everyone with the other question. What did you say? Come across anything to do with ADHD and OCD?
My psych placement in med school was 2 weeks long. And what that consists of is sitting in on clinics with a psychiatrist, and basically like kind of observing their interactions with patients. And then obviously we had the exam, like covering it as well, like following the placement. But in terms of like, did I sit on any clinics with diagnosed ADHD patients? Yes, maybe two or three, but they're all children under 12. Mm. Could I diagnose ADHD in a patient based on those criteria? Maybe, but I mean, I definitely wouldn't say that I'm kind of specialized to do that.
Yeah, no, it's just interesting because I guess as you said, there's like you do a certain amount of time sitting in a certain thing, you do your exam, and you have so much to learn as a doctor. And one of my friends who's a doctor as well, she's saying that, you know, sometimes, you know, you cram for an exam, you pass the exam, and you're like, okay, cool, like I don't want to specialize in that kind of thing. But it's interesting that I guess there are varying levels of focus on different parts of the practice of becoming a doctor, but mental health is becoming such a big part of our society, and there's so many issues because I guess, as we've spoken about before, like social media and mental health and like the amount we work and being burnt out, it's interesting that there's not more that kind of focus isn't expanding, because I think a lot more people are going to start needing help with their mental health as we continue to progress as a society.
But I guess, as you were saying, like what you were doing with pre and kind of post surgery, whether someone has ADHD or is bipolar probably would all come into how the patient acts. But actually, at the end of the day, I guess your main concern is that they're not, I don't know, the wound is, I don't know what I'm saying, you know what I mean? But I don't know how much would, like, you know, obviously, you know, a patient's history. So does that really change the way you care for them if they have a mental health diagnosis?
I mean, so the NHS is kind of split into teams. So if a patient comes in with a broken ankle, for example, and they need surgery is performed and they're recovering in hospital, we wouldn't allow them to leave hospital without being seen by the psych team.
Okay.
So we wouldn't directly deal with ourselves, but we would contact a team who are specialized to handle any psychiatric issues that they might have if we deem it necessary. Mm-hmm. So in terms of kind of the NHS is hyper specialized, so there's a team for absolutely everything. Yeah. So there is somebody
definitely,
exactly. Well, I say the NHS, but I mean I work at King's, which is one of the biggest hospitals in one of the four biggest hospitals in London. So obviously we have a lot more teams and a lot more ability to kind of cater to people with a range of conditions than a small district general hospital, like somewhere outside the M25.
Might vary.
But it all just comes down to like funding, really, doesn't it?
Yeah.
If you can't pay the people to be there, then you can't have the teams on site.
Yeah.
So I get like, and obviously you're not the Prime Minister, but just as a cheeky question.
I'm not.
I'd rather you than Boris any day. What do you like? I've thought about it, but I don't really understand how the system works well enough. But you're on the inside. What does the NHS?
Yeah, we clearly
need?
Have no understanding because everything we've said, he's like, you're like, no, so that's not how it works.
Actually, I'm like, so you couldn't diagnose me if I came in? You're like, there's actually a team. There's a psych team.
He's like, I deal with stab wounds.
What do you think the NHS needs, right, for it to get to a place where it's actually functional? Do you think it needs to be privatized? Like, from the inside, what would you change if you could change a few things? Sorry, it's a very big question. I just like, it'd be interesting because you obviously work on the inside.
Big question. I'm going to be on BBC News. Doctor says. It's going to sound really bad, but it comes down to money.
I thought you were going to be like, nothing.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't care.
Right.
No. Burn it to the ground. No, the NHS is such a unique system in global healthcare that it'll be such a shame to see it collapse. But the fact of the matter is, what it needs is more funding than is, I don't know if more funding than is possible for it to be given, or more funding than this government is willing to give it. But like, just needs a lot of money. There's a lot of people to pay.
Like, we'd spend like trillions of pounds a year on nuclear weapons and like
we other weapons. Use them. I mean, I know we're not in a nuclear war currently.
Well, like... yeah, but even if we, I feel like there are trillion. I can't really wrap my head around it, but there is money flowing around that they could put in towards NHS.
Like, you hear all the numbers, but it's kind of difficult to know like what's true, what's not true.
Yeah. There's a school of thought that says the government is basically, I'm not trying to do conspiracy theories, but essentially the idea is that...
it's not even a conspiracy theory.
No, it's actually like, there are quite a few like people think that the government, especially the Conservative government, is trying to overstrain the NHS to the point that it makes sense to then privatise it. Because obviously we constantly get told by the media that it's out of money and it needs money and it needs more funding and people are getting paid enough and there's no pay rises and the salary increase is £1 and blah, 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 all this kind of crazy stuff, right? So it's mass pushed to us that like it needs more money. It's that in a few years time when they're like, we're going to privatise it, but it means it gets more money, people won't be as adverse to it.
Is what I've like read. All their best mates own...
Yeah, exactly.
America, you know, own shit. And it's like Margaret Thatcher just loved selling stuff off. So like that's what they
good
want.
Old Maggie. That's a joke. I'm not a fan of Margaret Thatcher. My mum finds me and beats me up. Yeah, interesting. Okay, cool. Sorry, that was a very big question that I couldn't
basically
answer myself.
Guys, we need more money for the NHS.
That's a very fair, like, politically sound, like, I wouldn't use my job answer. True. We need more funding. cool. Well, again, thank you so much for actually doing this and joining so early in the year and in your evening. It means a lot. Hopefully you enjoyed this.
Yeah,
everybody wasn't too terrible, but yeah, thank you so much for coming on. It's been great to have you. It's nice to have a qualified doctor on that can actually just speak about how the inside works. So we talk about, like, you know, the medical side of things quite often, like we kind of like try and dip into medicine and like therapy and stuff. Obviously it's nice to have someone who's actually qualified to talk about stuff, and our disclaimer isn't as scary anymore. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing, and good luck with Health Push and
thank you.
The photography series. We'll try and highlight it on our page when it comes out as well, if possible.
Oh, thank you.
Of course.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Yeah,
thank you. Nice to meet you guys.
Have a good evening.
Yeah.
You too.